Hello and welcome, friends, to this week's edition of Truth to Power with me, your guest host, Justin Mogg. I'm one of the volunteers here at the station, and I'm excited to be hosting this week's edition of the program here on Forward Radio, your community radio station, WFMP LP Louisville, broadcasting to you from the historic Hayburn Building at 106.5 FM or live streaming anywhere you are in the world at forwardradio.org. That's also where you can go to become a part of this station, get your voice and your issues on the air. Click participate. Maybe you've got a topic or a guest that you'd love to see here on Truth to Power. We'd love to hear from you at forwardradio.org. And you can support the work anytime by clicking on the donate button. We've got our pledge drive coming up real soon for our 6th anniversary of broadcasting to the community. We rely on listener sponsorship, so please go to forwardradio.org now and help sustain us. Well, what I'm really thrilled to do on this week's Truth to Power is bring you a talk that was presented on February 23rd at the University of Louisville's Rauch Planetarium. It was the 2023 Minx Auerbach Lecture in Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, and it featured the amazing Dr. Trevia Lindsay. She's a professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University and co-founder of the Black Feminist Night School at Zora's House in Columbus. She's the author of the 2022 book, America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice. And you do not want to miss this really inspiring and important work, America Goddamn, right here on Truth to Power.
Good evening, everybody. It is such a pleasure to be in this community and to be talking with you about the lived experiences and material realities of Black girls, women, and gender expansive people. Nobody matters less to our society than young Black women. I remember reading those heartbreaking words in a 2013 Village Voice interview with journalist and author Jim DeRogatis. After nearly 15 years, at that point, of investigating and reporting on numerous allegations against Robert Kelly, more commonly known as R. Kelly, DeRogatis, a white man from Jersey City, publicly uttered a sentiment damning and resounding in its articulation. I remember nodding in agreement as he reached this soul-shattering conclusion that wasn't novel per se, but perhaps shocking to hear from someone like DeRogatis. When I interviewed him in 2019 about his then forthcoming book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, he once again reiterated Black girls and women's lack of mattering, and that nearly 20 years after he first became aware of and reported on the allegations against Kelly, people, institutions, and systems still fail to care for and protect those Black girls, victimized and tormented by the critically acclaimed and commercially successful singer, songwriter, and producer. In fact, he pointedly asserted that, quote, nobody cares about Black women and girls, end quote. This statement of non-mattering hit me in a different way this time. I knew it wasn't wholly true, and yet there was something affectively poignant about a full-throated recognition of how unjust, cruel, unloving, violent, vile, and wreckful this world could be in its treatment of Black girls and women. A Twitter conversation with Black Studies scholar Christina Sharp in late 2020 prompted me to dig into what bothered me about this cogent assertion made by DeRogatis and others. They weren't wrong, and yet there was a lack of precision in the framing of non-mattering. There is, after all, ample evidence that much of the world does not have any concern for the well-being of Black women and girls. When I first began researching America Goddamn, a Black woman or girl was being killed every 19 hours in the United States. By the time I submitted the final copy-edited version of my book manuscript to my publisher in early spring 2021, a Black woman or girl in the United States was being killed every 17 hours. Coming upon the one-year anniversary of the publication of my book, I sought new data about Black femicide. I cautiously, though foolishly, hoped for a decrease in the frequency with which Black women and girls are killed. Some part of me knew, however, that would not be what I found. The most recent data devastatingly conveyed a sobering truth. An average of 4 Black women and girls a day were killed most recently. During a global pandemic in which many of us sheltered in place for months, our proximity to premature and violent deaths increased. I could feel the rest of my time here today offering gutting statistic after statistic regarding Black women and girls as pertains to violent victimization, precarity, and being treated as disposable. And I would still not be able to offer us a full picture of what's occurring. There was one recent data point I wanted to highlight today before delving in that indicates an uptick in violence and harm against Black women and girls since my book was published. Black children between the ages of 5 and 12 are about twice as likely to unalive themselves as white children of the same age. A new study found that suicide rates among Black children and adolescents have recently been worsening. Between 2003 and 2017, deaths by suicide rose in this group, especially among Black girls, whose rate of increase was more than twice as high even of that of Black boys, which is one of the highest groups of increasing as well. It was a story of Isabella Faith Trickner. Her cornrows and colorful beads on the ends of her braids were intimately familiar to me. Bullying, anti-Black racism, and ableism led to her untimely death. I know all too well how violent and sometimes even death-dealing schools can be for Black girls like Isabella. In this story, nevertheless, it wasn't harsher discipline via suspensions or expulsions or physical assaults by school resource officers, i.e. cops, in our schools, disproportionately experienced by Black girls. It was a culture of bullying perpetuated by students and teachers in a predominantly white school in Utah. Isabella suffered verbal and physical attacks at school for months with no reprieve or protection. Her mother reported the abuse to the school and district officials. Nothing happened. Neither the school or the Davis School District did anything to protect Isabella or to intently hold her bullies accountable. The school and the district fostered a violent culture in which Isabella's cries and her mother's agony were summarily ignored. At a young age, Isabella learned just how cruel this world can be to Black girls, especially those with disabilities. Her loved ones called her Izzy. Their love and care for her, however, could not stop the terrorizing that she encountered day after day. For Isabella, the convergence of anti-Black racism and ableism proved fatal. And while officially the cause of death was suicide, the Davis School District was in the very least an accomplice to her tragic end. She was cared for, just not by those institutionally and systemically charged with caring for her. Let me now return to my hesitancy around the assertion of no one caring about Black women and girls. To say that no one cares fails to acknowledge those who do, those who work to protect and support them. Black women and girls have always looked out for each other. And more specifically, Black women doing this work have been unyielding in our commitment to uncovering, documenting, and amplifying what has happened and what continues to happen to us. In the not too distant past, I admit, I too proclaimed without qualification that no one cares about us, overlooking historical and recent examples of Black women showing up for and centering the plight of Black women and girls. Even as a queer Black feminist, I participated in the racist and sexist practice of erasing Black women's labor, the labor of people who are in this room, my own labor, those who are no longer with us, and those who paved the way for a field and a sense of organizing to be mined and created. I said no one cared because I was angry that far too few people beyond other Black women care about our histories with terror, or the energy Black women and girls expend documenting and struggling against injustice. This book required the fortitude and practice of witnessing, which I will discuss a little bit later. This witnessing model is something that I adopted from 17-year-old Darnella Frazier. This young black woman is the primary reason we witnessed exactly what happened to George Floyd on that fateful day of May 25th, 2020. Darnella recorded George's life being snuffed out and offered us visual confirmation of yet another horrifying example of black unmattering. According to her own testimony in the trial of Derek Chauvin, George's killer, she still wakes up in the middle of the night thinking about that day, George's last moments, and wondering if she could have done more. America, goddamn, is in this world to witness, and I still query if I could do more myself. The decision to write a book steeped in an unearthing history, in an unrelenting history, a history archived and existing in ancestral utterances and faintly audible, though knowable, whispers heard by those who are ourselves trying to outrun current technologies of anti-blackness and unfreedom was not an easy one. I tried to outrun this book. I was not confident in my own emotional and psychic fortitude to trace black women's experiences from what historian Stephanie Smallwood called the one-way route of terror to black women dying inside jail cells in Waller County, Texas. I knew that I could not tell a totalizing story of violence against black women, girls, and gender expansive people, whether I focused on our past or our recent history. There always has been resistance. An archive of black women's freedom in the United States commences at the point of capture. Their refusal of bondage included resistance during the transport to the Americas. The archive would not allow me to reduce black women and girls to only being casualties of anti-black violence, although I knew most of my book would be detailing and analyzing historical and recent violence against us. I followed in the footsteps of black women's historians who search for refusal and resistance and somehow write about trauma, terror, and tenacity with a life-affirming imperative undergirding our scholarship. The black women, girls, and gender expansive people I talk about in America, goddamn, are not objects of study. Their lives before we come to know them as a result of injurious or fatal harm matter deeply. Should their living loved ones or their descendants in generations not yet born come across my book, it is my hope that they feel as though I held their loved one warmly. It's important to me that an ethic of care rooted in my training and still evolving praxis as a black women's historian pervaded this book and is felt whenever I talk about violence against us. I thought about Ntozake Shange's groundbreaking choreo poem for colored girls who've considered suicide when the rainbow is enough and her call to handle black girls warmly. It stuck with me and it informed how I approached writing this book. It's simple gestures such as using first names to talk about those victimized by the cruelty of dispossession, marginalization, devaluation, deprivation, and exploitation. The book builds on an accountability to their loved ones and attempts to foster a sense of intimacy, if only fleetingly, between those engaging these stories and those directly impacted by the injurious or grave loss. It felt like one of the only ethical ways to write this book. With the ethical imperative in mind, what I sought out to do was to delve into a legible chronology from which the depths and expanse of violence against black women and girls in the United States became undeniable. I thought of Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn as a guide for form. This was Simone's first protest song, the first time she attempted to capture the pulse of resistance to the unrelenting impact of anti-blackness and white supremacy. Inspired by the assassination of civil rights worker Medgar Evers and the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, that killed 11-year-old Carol Denise McNair, 14-year-old Carol Rosanon Robinson, 14-year-old Addie Mae Collins, and 14-year-old Cynthia Dion Wesley, and severely injured preteen Sarah Collins. History would come to know these victims of domestic terror as the Four Little Girls. Unnamed and typically only symbolic of the inhumanity of white supremacist violence. But why do we often not say their names? Carol, Denise, Cynthia, Addie. They aren't just a historical moment. They were beloved and lived lives worth knowing more about than just their tragic endings. Addie was a Girl Scout. Carol was a pretty good singer, according to her sister. Some others had disputing narratives about her vocal talents. Denise loved math, and Cynthia aspired to be the best salesperson in all of Birmingham, Alabama. To write this book, I had to wrest myself of the impulse to only discuss the moments of harm. I wanted to include life-affirming details about those surviving, being worn down by, or being snuffed out by the wholly impossible. It was the least I could do. I returned to the slave ships and the historians who first gave me, us, an abundance of historical evidence about the wholly impossible. Enslaved women of African descent in the early modern period existed in a world that, as historian Jennifer L. Morgan emphatically notes, came into being through innumerable acts of violence and violation. And I thought about this most recently upon the clip of seeing Angela Davis being told by Henry Louis Gates that her ancestors, some came over on the Mayflower. And her response is this incredible discomfort and frustration and disbelief. And watching the responses to this has been quite fascinating. But the thing that has been little talked about by a lot of folks responding to it is that this becomes evidence of a form of sexual violence, forced breeding, and the pervasiveness of terror that the US nation, as we understand it, is given birth through the reproductive extractive labor of black women and girls. For me, America Goddamn is an exercise in witnessing and witnessing. In the book, I state that, quote, in addition to the historical record, I know all too well and too intimately how pervasive violence and other forms of systemic harm are among the black women and girls in my life, including myself. What I knew as a historian of black women and as a survivor of numerous acts of violence was that there is a heart-rending story to tell. Telling this story demanded a willingness to engage an excruciating past and compelled me to look into my own life and lay bare some of my own truths as a black woman. Witnessing entails a few things. Talking about all victims in life-affirming ways that do not reduce them to violent and sometimes death-dealing encounters. Attempting to remember the living, breathing joys of those assailed by the violence. And handling black people warmly through examining still evolving archives of violence as well as our resistance. To handle us warmly can also result in meaningful change. Due to advocacy from many protesting the way the media is complicit in the normalizing and acceptance of violent policing, in October of 2022, the AP, the Associated Press, recommended journalists avoid using vague jargon such as officer involved or police involved when discussing police brutality. In America Goddamn, I discuss how officer involved became the common phrase used by mainstream media outlets in the aftermath of Los Angeles police officers killing 39-year-old Eula Love in LA. As police violence intensified throughout the 1970s, local media began covering police violence against civilians. By the mid-1970s, the local papers in Los Angeles interchangeably use officer-involved and police-involved shooting to report on police officers shooting and, in some cases, killing civilians. The killing of Eula Love solidified the usage of the term by mainstream media outlets as the go-to for describing police shootings of civilians. What was noted was that with the exception of a single local black newspaper in Los Angeles at the time, the city's press identified the killing of Eula as an officer-involved shooting. So why is this language so important to understand? Officer-involved is passive. It doesn't tell us the role of the officer or officers played in the shooting. There's a world of difference between Treva shot someone and Treva was involved in a shooting. The passive description of a violent act works to evacuate responsibility or accountability from police officers. Mainstream publications across the US adopted the term and became complicit in an obfuscation of the reality of fatal police violence. The rhetoric of officer-involved shooting tells us that police killings are victimless crimes. By the time the story of Eula Love had reached the New York Times, the usage of officer involved to describe the fatal encounter had effectively erased her own victimhood. The term embeds bias into how the general public views, processes, and responds to the killing of a 39-year-old black woman in her own yard. The aftermath of a police killing weighs heavily on families and communities. I think here about Marquise Jefferson. Marquise Jefferson was the father of a Tatiana Jefferson, a black woman killed by police in Texas in October 2019. At 58 years old, he died from a heart attack despite having no prior heart issues. The death of his daughter and the resulting grief wore him down in less than a month after his daughter's killing. Since his death, Tatiana's mother and sister have passed away as well. Being multiply marginalized predisposes one to premature fatal outcomes, as well as perpetual proximity to violent and preventable deaths. New reasons to grieve are seemingly always just around the corner. According to anthropologist Kristen Smith, in the wake of the deaths of black people at the hands of the state, from the police to the prison system, the living are often weighted with a sadness that is too heavy to bear. And in the weeks and months following the initial death of a loved one, they become sick and many die prematurely. With the rest of my time today, I would like to pull closer to the work that I do around intracommunal violence against black women, girls, and gender expansive people. I want to drill down here because it was one of the hardest parts of the book to speak candidly about intracommunal violence while rejecting anti-black and pathologizing and criminalizing perspectives on the pervasiveness of violence against black women and girls. This is also where the Among Us part hit particularly close to home. And even as we talk right now, black girls, women, and gender expansive people are being harmed. It was happening while I was writing. It is happening whenever I speak. It is an ongoing and unrelenting reality. I had already turned in my book, actually, and was about to begin the copy editing process, which y'all know if you've written a book is like a very exciting point to get to in a process, especially a book this heavy where you get to hand it over to somebody else to sit with all of this grief and drama. But something happened. When I just turned it in, 16-year-old Makaya Bryant was killed by Columbus, Ohio police just a few minutes from where I live. I was beside myself, angry, furious, enraged. Not only by her death, but the nearly immediate justifying of her death by many who saw seconds of footage capturing her being gunned down outside of her foster home. She feared for her life in those last moments, and I was livid at the number of people who opted for using the gaze of policing, the same policing system that routinely assails, criminalizes, and even kills disproportionate numbers of black people, instead of witnessing what occurred. It took me a couple of days to inquire about the possibility of adding some mention of Makaya to my book. My editor, thankfully and warmly, said yes, and I wrote a love letter to her, which is now the end of the book. In the final words of the letter, I said, quote, "I recommit to being a warrior for worlds in which black girls are held warmly, lovingly, and in their our fullness. I understand there's no such thing as justice for you. I can, however, struggle for the abolition of these death-dealing systems with the hope that you know your beautiful life is a propelling force. Makaya, you now reside in my heart and in my spirit, and I will never forget to say your name. Makaya, Makaya, Makaya." One of my responsibilities as a historian of black women is world-making through the stories we recover and give life to, and the stories that get to the depths and complexities of our experiences. This epilogue, I believe, was the second hardest part of the book to write, and I actually reviewed it with her family before I sent it to my press to make sure they were on board, because they are actually the people I'm accountable to in this work. But back to what was the most difficult. In the book, I tell a story about an incident of intimate partner violence I witnessed when I traveled home to the DC area in June 2020. This particular incident and all that occurred after, my mom and I pulled over to assist a young black woman who had been thrown out of the car by someone she cared for, was the moment I decided that I was going to finally write this book about violence black women against black women and girls. I finally felt I had the most emotional capacity to do so. The entire incident was a lot to process, and part of my processing was how frequently I witnessed Black girls being harmed in interpersonal and intimate context. More often than not, I attempted to intervene with my body when I was present for the violent act. The frequency with which I found myself witnessing and feeling compelled to witness made these particular forms of violence hard to ignore. Just a couple of months after bearing witness and witness to this young woman's assault, one of my favorite rappers, Megan Thee Stallion, went on Instagram Live to share details about an allegation of a violent encounter she had with fellow rapper Tory Lanez, also known as Daystar Peterson. Prior to this very public disclosure, Meg's statements about being shot in her foot were scrutinized, derided, and dismissed by a considerable number of people. Her decision to share her truth resulted in a barrage of jokes, silence from damn near everyone within the popular music industry, specifically within the rap music industry, and a palpable lack of sympathy. Her pain didn't matter. And her initial IG Live, when she identified her attacker as Daystar Peterson, she explained why she didn't cooperate with police and defended her decision to protect everyone in the car with her on the night of her violent assault, including the perpetrator. Megan noted that, quote, "Even though he shot me, I tried to spare him, and y'all aren't sparing me," end quote. Meg knew the police could escalate the situation and potentially harm her and him. She couldn't trust the police even at a moment when she needed someone to care for her. She received backlash for protecting him and for sharing her truth. Numerous people found a way to villainize the victim of a shooting. Her pain was either illegible or unimportant. Her case brought me back to a question that propelled the crafting of a chapter focused on intracommunal experiences of violence. How do Black women and girls and gender expansive people navigate patriarchal, gender, and sexual violence within our communities? Often, we silently endure and unequivocally protect. The impulse to protect those who harm us emerges out of a desire to care for ourselves without relying on the state to intervene or further criminalize and pathologize Black people. It shouldn't be fantastical to not want to give any more lives to the criminal punishment system to devour and to want us to be cared for and unharmed in our intimate relationships, homes, institutions, and communities. Both can be true. The learned compulsion to protect those who harm us from the criminal punishment system, however, can often leave us silent, bruised, battered, or worse, dead. I have a personal, dreadfully abundant archive of Black women, friends, family members, colleagues who have been sexually assaulted, raped, battered, or killed in intimate and interpersonal contexts. In the book, I note that by my mid-30s, I knew three women personally who had been killed by their partners. And although this archive was telling a harrowing story on its own, my training as a historian really pushed me back into the archive. I wasn't going to leave the personal behind because that's what propelled it and that's what propels this work, but I wanted a broader archive of intimate and interpersonal violence. And so it was interesting again to see Angela Davis's reaction to what she found from this ancestry show. And it reminded me of her germinal article, 1971 article, Reflections on the Black Women's Role in the Community of Slaves. So she's literally written about the thing that is being revealed and sensationalized in this review. Davis attempts to recover the lived experiences of enslaved women in this article. Chattel slavery produced a context in which enslaved people of all genders faced the daily threat of white supremacist violence. But it is nearly impossible to understand the violence of chattel slavery without talking about sexual violence against enslaved people. One of the most common forms of violence used against Black women and girls was rape and sexual assault. Understanding rape as being a form of institutional terrorism that is designed to subjugate rather than an individualized spontaneous act of violence is perhaps one of the most significant interventions that Davis made with this article. Similar to when Ida B. Wells called out the frequency with which white men assaulted African-American women in the late 19th century, Davis had illuminated rape as a prominent facet of white supremacist and patriarchal violence. A tool of both social control and forced reproductive labor, the commonness of white men raping Black women and girls during slavery is foundational to grasping gender-specific experiences of enslaved people.
And I'm breaking in to remind you that we're listening to Dr. Trevia Lindsay, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University, author of the new book, America Goddamn Violence, Black Women and the Struggle for Justice. She spoke at the University of Louisville on February 23rd in the Minx Auerbach Lecture for Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at U of L. And we return you now to the Rausch Planetarium at U of L from February 23rd with Dr. Trevia Lindsay.
And without question, Black men and boys experienced rape and sexual assault as well, particularly in the context as well of forced breeding, compulsory intimacies, as well as castration. As Emily West has argued, quote, because rape and sexual assault have been defined in the past as non-consensual acts supported by surviving legal evidence, it is hard for historians to research rape and sexual violence under slavery, end quote. This difficulty has not stopped Black women's historians, however, from looking at the archive and seeking out those meaningful silences and those hidden in plain sight truths about slavery. One of the most difficult parts of the history of slavery in the U.S. to recover are enslaved women's experiences with intimate partner violence, specifically intercommunal sexual violence. There was no legal standing for the rape of enslaved women or the rape of any woman within marriage. For enslaved women, perpetrators could be slave owners, and in some cases, as we're coming to understand, fellow enslaved men. Violence against enslaved women and girls isn't only a story about white supremacy or racial capitalism. It's also about more intimate, harmful interactions occurring within a marginalized, exploited, and violated community. Until I read Deborah Gray White's pioneering book on Black women and slavery, which is called Aren't I a Woman? Female Slaves in the Plantation South, I hadn't really fully understood the extent to which violence occurred among enslaved communities. I only really thought about the violence of slave owners. What Deborah Gray White drives home is that while there were slave women raped by Black men, this abuse is overshadowed by white male exploitation of Black women. And it is overlooked because it hardly ever turned up in court since there were no legal injunctions against it, end quote. I dug deeper into the work of Black women's historians and found that they were asking difficult but important questions about patriarchal violence among enslaved people. When historian Sasha Turner asked, to what extent were enslaved men collaborators in the subordination and sexual abuse of enslaved women, I braced myself for what the archives might say. While the fear of slave owners predominated, some enslaved women and girls suffered at the hands of those whom they shared the non-person status of chattel. The placing of enslaved women into households where enslaved men were positioned as head of household reproduced Euro-patriarchal standards violently and granted household heads unrestricted sexual access to their dependents. This imposed organization of enslaved household ushered in a particular form of Black patriarchal power over Black women, even as these enslaved men were victimized by their owners' expectations and machinations. So it's also a form of violence against Black men and boys that's happening in this process. This combined force of white supremacy and patriarchy and deep roots that it travels out in understanding more contemporary violence and the realities of both white supremacists and patriarchal violence as always and ever intertwined. With white supremacy always surveilling and in search of justifications for its anti-Black core, calling out violence at the hands of men being lynched by the same people, raping and lynching you was unfathomable for Black women and girls during slavery and post-slavery. The penchant for protection comes at a high cost though. Bruises are unattended, care is unafforded, and pain is often ignored. Airing this dirty laundry, however, means risking being labeled as a race traitor or a henchwoman for white supremacy by calling out the specific violence of patriarchy. Even worse, allegations often could alienate you from the very community you needed to help you survive in an intractably anti-Black world. Under the watchful eye of white supremacy, Black women and girls often made difficult and make difficult choices about their vulnerability and well-being at both interpersonal and systemic levels. It is common for folks in understanding this discussion of culture of dissemblance, which is one way of framing this, as coined by Darlene Clark Hine, as a way to not fully grasp all that Hine is talking about when she's discussing black women trying to dissemble, one, and trying not to bring harm or further harm to their communities by coming forward about harm that's happening in intimate and interpersonal contexts. Hine unambiguously acknowledges the desire of black women to escape sexual exploitation from inside and outside of their families. Chronicling why black women migrated out of the South into the Midwest in particular, she uncovered that, quote, the most common and certainly the most compelling motive for running, fleeing, migrating was a desire to retain or claim some control and ownership of their own sexual selves, beings, and the children they bore. Right? Hine is so pointed in knowing that black women are involved in a multifaceted struggle to determine who would control their reproductive and productive capacities, as well as their sexuality. The archives of gender and sexual violence against black women and girls are limited because black women have often chosen to hide their experiences as a mode of protection for themselves and sometimes their families and communities. In the late 1960s and 70s, at the height of the civil rights movement, black power, women's liberation, and queer liberation movements, black women became more explicit in their calling out of violence against them, particularly from intercommunal and interpersonal space. Through poetry, fiction, nonfiction, speeches, plays, choreo poems, and debates, black women refused silence. Many opted out of a politics that saw the discussion of their victimization at the hands of people within their communities as divisive. Black feminists and womanists brought the fire to those who thought that violence against black women and girls was secondary to black freedom struggles. In her poem, 1978 poem, Woman Slaughter, Pat Parker chronicled the murder of her sister, Shirley Jones, by Jones's husband. One of the most striking lines of the poem reads, "Her things were his, including her life. Jones's husband possessed her, and he could therefore treat her as disposable. Her sister's killer spent 1 year in a work release program. The rather lenient response from the criminal punishment system to this heinous act of violence compelled Parker to bring her sister's murder to the International Tribunal of Crimes Against Women in Brussels in 1976. She knew her sister's life mattered, and that patriarchy, misogyny, and white supremacy stole Jones's life and barely held anyone accountable. Those who saw black women's truth-telling as anti-black viewed black feminists and womanists as inimical to black liberation. Tensions continued to bubble to the surface with how we confront intercommunal violence and patriarchal violence, more specifically, against black women, girls, and gender-expansive people in the 21st century. I'm thinking once again here of Megan. Black women are still viewed as divisive when they talk about their experiences. We still contend with demands from many within our communities to focus on the shared enemy of white supremacy. As historians of black women and girls experiences and material realities, it is, however, our job to wrestle with the combined impact of white supremacy, patriarchy, and systemic oppressive forces on the lives of black women and girls. It hit me as it pertained to my dear friend Erica Peters, who was killed by her ex-partner. He also killed two of her children in one of the most brutal domestic violence murders in recent Washington, D.C. history. I had been thinking about her a lot as I wrote this book, a lot as I prepared for this talk, particularly because we are coming up on about 14 years of her no longer being with us. But I also thought about it because we are seeing an uptick in these kinds of murders, these family murders, right? Father killing his wife and several kids, that we've seen a number of these to begin the year. And this is cutting across race, right? But most of the stories that we tend to hear, we don't get who's behind this, what's motivating this, how we talk about patriarchal violence in more robust and meaningful ways. As I was writing this, I also thought, because we're coming up on another anniversary, about the young black girl from my hometown I dedicated my first book to and wrote about in America Goddamn, Felicia Rudd. She was failed by every system, by caretakers, and by institutions. I dedicated my first book to her in hopes that we would find her and she would read and know we never forgot her in a book. I talked about her in America Goddamn because I also wanted to talk about the violence of everydayness. What is unlivable living? What does it mean to be unhoused? What does it mean to be food insecure? What does it mean not to have clean water? what does it mean to be someone who's criminalized for living with addiction as opposed to treat it like a patient living with addiction, right? I talk about in the book black women being crack whores, and right now we're in the crisis of the opioid patient. There's a real difference in the rhetorical ways we talk about that, a criminalizing response versus a health-based response, and how that criminalizing response to Relisha's mother set in motion a set of events that led to the disappearance of Relisha Rudd. To this day, I still hope she is found alive, though day after day that possibility is less likely, but I made a commitment to saying her name every time. We must also go to the margins of the margins, too, if we seek to share histories of those predominating narratives that predominating narratives tend to exclude. One of the other things I wanted to make sure America Goddamn did was grapple with the distinct impact of anti-transness on black women. On July 25th of 1866, in the aftermath of the Memphis riots, an official report was printed regarding what transpired. The report indicated numerous atrocities committed against black Union soldiers, black residents, and black and white Union sympathizers. The report also described the rape of five black women as the, quote, crowning acts of atrocity and diabolism committed during these terrible nights, and as licentious brutality. Ultimately, five black women testified before Congress about what occurred. Rebecca Ann Bloom on May 12th, 1866, Lucy Tibbs on May 30th, Harriet Armour on May 31st, and Lucy Smith and Frances Thompson on June 1st. The last to testify, Frances Thompson, was a black trans woman who would later also be criminalized because of her gender identity. She reported that a group of seven Irishmen, as she defined it from her testimony, broke into her home in the middle of the night, demanding dinner, drinks, and eventually sex. Four of the men raped and beat Frances Thompson. These men also stole money and other goods, including her food, and pillaged the house. Now, it's quite something to think about and visualize black women testifying before Congress in the 1860s, let alone a black woman challenging the presumptive cisness of womanhood in 1866. Right? So long before we have the Anita Hill image that's etched into many of our memories testifying before Congress, and the more recent of Christina Blasey Ford testifying before Congress, it is a black trans woman who sets the precedent for Me Too. A deeper dive into the distinct violence endured by black trans women throughout history is books and books I anxiously await. I've seen the danger of data without historical context. For example, and many of you may have heard this, there was a statistic floating around a few years ago about the average life expectancy for a black trans woman being 35 years old. I remember being startled by this and wanting to know how this study was conducted. Before I did a thorough check, my bad, I repeated the statistic because I thought it conveyed what other data I had seen told us. In 2016, publication released a database tracking the deaths of transgender homicide victims. Between 2010 and 2016, 75% of the transgender and gender nonconforming people killed were black trans women. This means that between 2010 and 2016, a black trans woman was killed every month. 82 trans people, most of whom were black women and girls and gender variant people, were killed between 2017 and 2019. In the first 7 months of 2020 alone, the number of black trans homicide victims surpassed the total number for 2019. And keep in mind, in 2020, for the most part, we're sheltering in place. This is what violence against black women looks like in the 21st century. With this data, the 35-year-old life expectancy figure didn't seem improbable. I also recognize that my repeating of it to talk about the crisis of black trans women wasn't a life-affirming or witnessing approach to this issue. It turns out the statistic came from a poorly conducted study and that there isn't yet available data that tells us about the distinct ways trans misogynoir and anti-blackness converge in the fatal outcomes for black trans, of black trans women. So what that meant is we were repeating a deadly statistic that was doing death-dealing harm as well. By saying that the life expectancy of someone is that premature, right? Imagine if you're a black trans woman hearing that. What does that do psychologically? What does that do to your emotional state of being? What does that do in terms of your relationship to life, right? So it's important that we understand it and do more research to actually get the data to support this and to support resources that will center Black trans women in the ways that we mobilize. We need more witnessing, more people concerned with the margins of the margins, new ways of knowing and listening, and more warmth while being critically generative and generous in the ways that we remember, in the ways that we honor, in the ways that we hold people warmly, in the ways that we envision the lives of those taken from us. The undervaluing of the labor and commitment of those of us who do care and show up for Black girls, women, and gender expansive people in our work looms large in the broader field of inquiry, of feminist inquiry. Black women's historians and feminist organizers, scholars, artists, and activists continue to uncover new and understudied histories of Black women's participation in social transformation. In our scholarship and our activism, we wrestle with the ways anti-Blackness manifests in areas such as the criminal legal system, healthcare, news media, and popular culture. And we also tirelessly amplify the historical multitude of experiences of us. We use archival unearthings of stories of those conscripted to navigate the wholly impossible, to show time and time again the death-dealing contours of anti-Blackness, patriarchy, imperialism, capitalism, settler colonialism, ableism, and other oppressive systems predicated on extraction, exploitation, unfreedom, and dispossession. I am thankful to be a part of a tradition of scholars and activists and artists who tell these stories, who invite us into the practice of witnessing, who demand that we hold Black women and girls warmly. At the end of America, goddamn, I chose hope, somehow. This was not easy. And though I learned from an echo prison abolitionist and author Miriam Kaba's notion of hope as a discipline, it was not easy to land there at the end of researching and writing America, goddamn. But what helped me to the finish line was being part of an ongoing tradition of world rendering and world making that is at the core of Black women surviving. We are indeed who we've been waiting for. Thank you. All right, so I think we have time for questions.
I am curious of you expanding more on that last piece of how you are holding all that trauma, the history, and your ongoing research around soul care and looking at leadership approaches that you have found in your research to hold that space and grief.
Yeah. So let me be completely transparent, right? I don't know that I had the healthiest or best process in writing this book or the aftermath of this book, right? The majority of this book was written during the first part of COVID in 2020, right? So I was locked at home. And it was also very soon after my father passed, right? So I was dealing with a particular form of personal grief while writing this. But this was a book I told him about that I was going to write. And he was like, make sure you got your therapist on call during this and that your friends know that you're writing this. And then all of a sudden, I was home by myself and you couldn't touch anyone, you couldn't see people, you couldn't do the things that you would normally do to grieve and be present and grieving the loss of all of these different stories. Because I mentioned Micaiah Bryant's family because I was in constant, remain in constant contact with them. But almost everyone in this book, I talked to their loved ones before I put them in the book. So it was very important to me that this was part of their process as well and holding that lovingly. So I never woke up writing about this book and I never went to sleep writing about this book. In fact, that I anchored it with like probably Golden Girls in the morning, if anyone knows me, as like things I love to watch and like really bad reality television at night. I've watched everything of Love is Blind, Japan, Brazil, US, all the seasons, After the Altar, and all kinds of things. But the thing what I've learned about leadership for me and thinking about care and who I connected to for me was always finding spaces of world making and joy as Black feminist practice, right? That there had to be a way that I was already practicing freedom in a world that told me that I am unfree. So I had to practice that through spending time with loved ones, watching things, indulging in things, caring on me, touching the people I love, and doing that. Leaders really taught me to create space and build that into my schedule as much as I built in writing time or built in anything else that seemingly was mandatory, that I had to prioritize world making as a practice of care. That I'm writing this because I want to see a different world. And so part of wanting to see that different world was actively living in that world prior to its actual creation, right, as a way of care. And so I also, you know, the Knapp Ministry, shout out Tresha Hersey, right, Rest is Resistance, that I take that very seriously now in a way that I was rise and grind. That used to be my hashtag. Full before 40, like everything was on this path. And so really resisting that in honor of my ancestors who were extracted and exploited in such unrelenting ways, to really feel that. And so rest became an intentional part of this, because everything we do is wearing us down, which is a really robust definition of what racism actually is and what it does. As Ruth Wilson Gilmore tells us, right, it's the predisposal of premature death because it's slowly wearing you down. And so the resistance to that is rest and being intentional. And so creating spaces for that and being a part of projects that demanded that I rest.
First, I wanted to say that it was just a pleasure to hear you speak. And I guess I was just wondering, the work that you do is super important, and I'm sure you're already aware that you tell a lot of truths that people don't necessarily want to hear. And I was just wondering how you navigate telling the truth in a world that doesn't want to doesn't want to hear the truth.
Okay. I was about to give you my like DC girl answer. So let me think of my academic answer. I was like, I don't give a fuck, right? That's one real like reaction. But I think the more astute reaction to it is that truth telling has always come at a cost, right? In a world that is so hell-bent and anchored on lies, right? We're on the lie of United States right now. We're on literally someone's land, right? And so we're literally sitting in a lie. So to me, the truth telling is literally the least I can do to honor a tradition in which settler colonialism continues, in which the extraction of labor from enslaved Africans continues in very robust ways, in which patriarchal violence takes the lives of so many people across genders on a daily basis, right? And so contending with that for me is that, one, I got crew and I got village. Right, I'm not doing this alone. Like, this book has singularly my name, but my acknowledgments are long, because it's community, it's the family, it's the loved ones, it's the folks who held me up, the folks who would tell me I could do it, the folks who are supporting the loved ones who are still grieving the loss of their loved one that I feel accountable to. So it's really hard for me to be afraid to tell the truth to someone who I'm not accountable to. I'm not accountable to white supremacists. I'm not accountable to transphobes. I'm not accountable to misogyny. I'm not. Like, I don't move in that way. It doesn't mean I'm fearless. It just means that the truth-telling impulse is an imperative for me that outweighs whatever kind of, oh no, what happens if this happens to this, right? Because there were consequences for my ancestors that were far more drastic than may happen to me for telling the truth.
If you could expand on how ableism in our society uniquely primes disabled people for police violence,
yes.
Or how intra-community discussions surrounding disability really fail each other and disabled people to be aware of how police violence is going to be different if you are disabled.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So this was something when I was doing my research that just knocked me over, right? That particularly thinking about police killings, that anywhere from, and this also comes with a framing of disability within our society, because the ways that invisible disability, unrecognizable disability, from the ways that an ableist society determines who is disabled and who is not, and the law defines that, that this is why the statistics are gonna sound wild, that anywhere from 33 to 50% of police killings are of disabled people. And the ways that ableism, anti-blackness, and misogyny intersect in that means that a large number of the black women who are killed by police that I talked about in the book are black disabled women. Whether that is Tanisha Anderson,
or Deborah Danner, who literally writes about being feared that she's going to be killed like Eleanor Bumpers, and she ultimately is, right, in New York, and talking about living life as a Black disabled woman. So part of this is the ways that ableism is also so interconnected with anti-Blackness and the ways that it operates and the ways that it shows up in terms of policing and violence. We also use policing to respond to everything, right? So we don't actually understand and contextualize, right, what happens when someone is in need of help, of assistance, of being held, of being cared for warmly. And policing is the automatic response to that. And policing tells us who should be criminalized. And disability is criminalized. Disability is criminalized, it is demonized, and it is seen as someone who is unfit in particular ways. And of course, this is a range of what disabilities are. And so I think that coupling that with Blackness, which is also criminalized, devalued, and you couple that with capitalism and compound that with other forms of violence, you're going to have instances in which folks who are multiply marginalized through ableism, anti-Blackness, and misogyny are going to be overrepresented in those harmed by the state, right? And intracommunally, right, without the resources, without the capacity to actually grapple with and talk about disability justice in ways that are generative and put disabled people at the center of those conversations, we're going to continue to see those kinds of numbers in both intracommunal and institutional and systemic forms of violence.
So in the book, you talk about how living as a marginalized person really becomes its own pre-existing condition.
Yes.
And then during the talk, we also touched on how being so routinely exposed to trauma, like, will manifest out of nowhere to give you something that's not documented before.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, can you maybe elaborate on some other ways that living as multiply marginalized mm-hmm. inherently creates a world in which you cannot escape medical trauma, or where that becomes a pre-existing condition?
Yeah. So in the book, there's also a chapter, thank you for that question, specifically about like the medical industrial complex and medical violence, and talking about anti-Blackness as a pre-existing condition that is embedded in the ways that healthcare shows up. So I go through the kind of history of why medicine is anti-Black and all of these other things, right? But to narrow in and to zero in on this climate of grief that's created, this climate of trauma that's created, that often multiply marginalized folks are navigating, means that when you do get to some kind of health practitioner within the system, the chance that you're coming in there with your body already being worn down or being harmed is much higher than someone who's not trying to outrun multiple forms of systemic oppression, right? So it means that when a Tatiana Jefferson is killed, right, she's killed in the house when she's there with her nephew, right? So there's the active grief of that. Her father passes away, right, soon after, from a heart, never had heart anything, then the mother, then the sister. Now there are people who are in the family who have the compounded grief of multiple losses surrounding one particular incident. And mind you, there were pre-existing incidents before that of their encounters with anti-Blackness, with capitalism, with the various systems of oppression that were already extant in their lives prior to this spectacular moment of harm. And so for me, understanding how multiply marginalized people are affected by this and have these lingering effects that show up in all these other places is that often we get the spectacular moment of harm and not the slow death. Right, thinking of Lauren Berlant, or thinking about the ways that all of these other things are slowly chipping away at the body. It's nick after nick after nick after nick, and you never stop the bleeding of any of the nicks. So eventually, slowly, you bleed out. And to resist that, and I don't want to put this in this kind of holy space of not thinking about resistance that's happening along the way, joy and world making that's happening along the way, but imagine all that we could do as multiply marginalized people if we weren't multiply marginalized. Thinking about all of the things, all of the freedom dreams that could have already been actualized if the people who have been harmed the most weren't being harmed, right? That there's actually a cost to that, that is something that we often don't measure. That multiple marginalization literally limits the ways we can world make and build. And people are still world making and building in spite of those things, right? It's the call of Nanny Helen Burroughs of we who are surviving the wholly impossible. what if you could just survive? And it's not the wholly impossible. If we took the wholly impossible off the table, what does that world look like? Right? What do those bodies look like? What does that health look like? What does that planet look like? Right? If we took all of those things into consideration.
Hello. I have a question about, I guess, the distinction between Black womanhood and Black girlhood, because mm-hmm. I see that distinction in the title of the book. Just because I've done a few projects on Black girl adultification.
Yes.
And so kind of like the blur between girlhood and womanhood.
Yes.
And so in your journey of writing this book, kind of what have you kind of, you know, I guess had to mourn in your Black girlhood, or what work have you had to do to kind of see what type of things you had to deal with as a Black girl? Mm-hmm. And when did you make that transition into your own womanhood? Because I still feel like I'm a girl,
right?
Sometimes I'm like, yeah. I'm just a girl. I'm like, oh no, I'm a woman actually, I think. And I don't know. Yeah. But just kind of what's your process with
right
that?
So I think girlhood and womanhood for me are not as well. So one, I'm really enthralled and excited by the growing field of Black girlhood studies, because I do think there's something very particular about childhood and Black childhood in particular, and thinking about Black age. I'm thinking of the work here for Biba Ibrahim and kind of interrogating age in a different way, because I still identify as a Black girl. I've never grown out of, right? Because I don't necessarily see it tied specifically only to aging into a particular form of adulthood. Because Black life is never given those same markers as other places, right? Black girls have been defined as women, as other, as adult, as well before the kind of usual prescriptive times of when that occurs for most other people. And there's something about the framing of girlhood is untethered to these markers of age and aging. They're about particular kinds of experiences and the porousness of moving through the world with a certain kind of knowing, and those different moments of knowing that come into being. The certain ways that you're relating to the world and examining the world. There are times when I'm examining the world as a Black girl and thinking through the world and thinking with the world as a Black girl. And there are other moments where that feeling of womanhood may sneak up on me and I'll embrace that. And I have a very reluctant relationship to womanhood because of the ways that womanhood has been violently used and weaponized against Black gendered people, right? People gendered as feminine. And so I think in writing this book, and the title really is, I hate to say this, like it was a really a fit thing of like the book of like having like Black women and girls. And then I wanted to have like Black women, girls, and gender expansive. And it became really challenging from like literally from an editorial standpoint, from a book cover standpoint. Which may be the most unsatisfying answer ever. But in the book, I wanted to really do distinctions of when I'm talking about someone who's experiencing particular traumas that I do think are uniquely situated to those marked as Black and girl, right? Because there's the imposition of who is Black and girl, and then there's the embracing of like what it is to live Black girlhood. And those don't always have to be the same, right? I don't think that those two things are intimately tethered in a way that they can't be disentangled, right? That also opened up space for Black gender expansive youth in ways, and talking about this as Black youth are figuring out their own gender identities and their relationship to gender and allowing that, but seeing that Black girls who are suspended more from school, girls who are read as Black and girl, are often suspended, expelled, disciplined, harmed in schools in very significant ways that matter. So I wanted to talk about that experience and how the adultification, because there's certain stereotypes about those who are Black and woman, are also imposed upon Black and girl and harmed in ways that we would find just devastating if this person were white and girl, right? In that. So it's a both and conversation with me.
Hello.
Hi.
So with a lot of these names I've heard because of social media, and I just wanted to know if you think that the sharing of videos of police brutality against Black people is more helpful or harmful. Personally, I think that it's done a number in desensitizing you know, how we view violence against Black people, just because it's becoming so normalized. And a lot of the videos, you know, they're extremely graphic. And I just wanted to know your view and if you think that it's more helpful or harmful, and like how we should kind of navigate, because obviously we still need to have these conversations, mm-hmm. but it's like at what cost, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. So I don't watch videos of Black people being killed. I don't watch people being killed. That's just, I think the last video that I watched of someone being killed, I had to watch different things for this book. So I preface it by saying that, and read autopsies and read. It was a very kind of heartbreaking way to do this. I would not, 100% do not recommend. But I accidentally, when the rapper Takeoff was killed, like the video automatically played on something that I was scrolling past, and so I couldn't sleep for like a week after that. My main goal in writing this book is never to be desensitized to the kind of violence that I'm talking about. Even though I frequently have to talk about this, as you saw as I'm talking, I still get very emotional talking about this. I never want a point where I can get through my talk and not have an emotional moment. These are real people realizing grieved, and it is a way that Black life becomes an object of study. And I believe at this point we're looking at snuff films, to be perfectly honest. If you need any more evidence that Black people are being killed, and that more often than not, I mean, if we look at the report most recently of what the report says of what happened to Tyree Nichols and what people were able to watch and see, or what the report said of what George Floyd, or what the report said for Ayanna Stanley Jones, or what the report said for Eula Love, that you are still unconvinced, this is not even a point. You've already decided of a level of unmattering that Black life has for you. And so there is something deeply pornographic about the ways that people are consuming Black death and injury in this moment. And I think that we would do well first to protect our own spirits at a personal level, but also to question why this visual evidence or this sense of this, and people will go back to, well, Mamie Till. And it's like, there's a very specific historical context in which Mamie Till is deciding to show the body, the battered body of her brutalized and tortured son to the world. How many other people's children, loved ones, need to be shown to you to convince you of Black life mattering?
We're on the conversation of emotions right now, and emotionalism and Black women haven't been seen in the best light. So how do you balance, specifically in writing, how do you balance dealing with such an emotional topic that you see yourself in this work, right? How do you balance that as well as that academic tone that kind of desensitizes all that emotion?
Yeah. There's nothing desensitized about this book, if I'm honest. It's on an academic press, so that, you know, I went through a peer review process and all of that other stuff, but I was very clear with all of the editors that I met with what kind of voice was writing this book. That this book would go to the families of those who were harmed before it would go to your reviewers. That Black girls, women, gender expansive folks in my communities were going to be some of my harshest critics about how this book was written. I don't want to write a book that Relisha couldn't pick up and see herself and read. And that doesn't mean there might be a word here and there, and it's like, I don't know what that means, but that I do the work then of saying, this is what this means, and this is why it matters that I use this word here. So there was something very intentional in this book about putting my own story in there, putting the stories of loved ones in there, and not treating the Black women, girls, and gender expansive people as objects of study in the book. That meant that I had to find a different kind of writing voice to write this book. That I put the I in there very early. And I say the stakes are high for me writing this. The stakes are high for my mother. The stakes are high for my friends. The stakes are high for my goddaughters. The stakes are high for Black people. The stakes are high for trans folks. The stakes are high. So bogging that down for me in words that are going to take you forever, that you get so bogged down here that you miss the story and you miss what is effective and affective about the work that I'm attempting to do here, would be a loss. And that would be a failure for me as a project. So there was something very intentional about moving away from academic voice. And before I wrote this book, I started writing more in public outlets to prepare to write in a different kind of way than I wrote my first book. So I started writing for Ms. and Cosmopolitan and Time and Bustle, like different, like who are the people who would pick up an 800 word story about this thing? And then how do I convince them to read an 80,000 word book, right? About this thing, which meant stories, which means in the books I'm talking about riding in the car with my dad listening to the NWA, or going to get my hair creamed with my mama. Like there are moments in there of levity and of joy that I'm riding in this with you, and I'm hurting alongside you, and I'm breathing alongside you while reading this. I'll say I did the audiobook for this, which I didn't expect to be the one reading it. So I had to read the book again, which I was like, damn, I did not plan to do this, right? I did not plan to have, and I had like the engineer in the back crying, and we had to keep recording because his crying got caught on the tape, right? Because it's a hard book, I would never pretend. But part of it's hard, not because it's hard to get through when you're sitting with the thesaurus and feeling like you're not there. If you are a Black girl, woman, and gender expansive, I want to feel like you're on the page and you're in that room with me. And so that required a very real engagement with a different kind of voice and a different kind of accountability and a different citational practice. So there's a lot of citations in this book. It's like, I'm a historian, so there's hundreds and hundreds of citations in this book. And so most people look at that as like academic rigor. And I'm like, no, that's who I'm collaborating with. That's who I'm thinking with. That's who I'm indebted to. That's who I'm in conversation with. And if you think of citation as collaboration and community, then it should be full of citations. It should be full of ways that you're engaging the folks who helped shape your thinking and who you're in conversation with for us to get free. This is a us issue, not a me issue. Yes.
Well, we have one question, one more back here, just one more. I'm sorry.
Hello.
Hi.
I like how you touched on the fact that you want us to be able for Black women and girls and gender expansive people to feel like we are on the pages. And reading, throughout reading the book, I do feel that way. This is our reality. And I almost don't want to ask you this question because it's not fair to put on you, but how are we supposed to sustain ourselves knowing that this is our reality every day and being able to intellectualize it? And you're doing the work, you're dealing with your own grief, you're dealing with the grief of others and those who you haven't even met. How are you able to sustain yourself and your work and remain hopeful in a country and in a world who not only doesn't value us, but continues to devalue us?
Yeah. That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. This is gonna sound a little hokey, a little bit, I think. So when I say love, I mean love as an accountability practice, right? Of the ways that we show up for one another. In the beginning, when I talked about that, like no one cares about Black girls, and I like that no one bothering me the second time I heard it. Cause like I live in a world where other Black girls, women, and gender expansive people are who continue to do amazing and wonderful things. That's the thing that gives me hope. We are already practicing freedom in a world that's doing all of those terrible things to us, right? So I'm not saying we're doing those things to sustain. We're literally doing them because they're amazing. And because we are committed to beauty, we are committed to freedom worlds, we are committed to worlds not yet made, right? And so for me, what sustains me is because I'm already in community with these Black women, girls, and gender expansive people who see other possibilities. I get to live in their freedom dreams, and that's a hell of a place to live, right? Especially in a world that is nightmarish time and time and time again, that I choose actively, right? I discipline myself to return to dreaming, right? To return to envisioning, to return to what my ancestors were dreaming of, right? And I don't have a concept of exactly. I have a lot of different kinds of ancestors, so some probably have some very different contending dreams, right? Maybe even competing dreams. But I know that they dreamed. And I know that we can practice moving through those in real ways that allows us to breathe and to live and to love and to seek and to really create abundance in spite of. I think often we see those things only in terms of resistance and not simply in the terms of living in and of itself on its own terms, that Black women, gender expansive people, multiply marginalized folks don't get to move through the world in this kind of, I hate to use sports reference, offensively. We're always defensively, right? Defensive posturing. Just because this is happening, I'm gonna do this in resistance to this, or this in resistance to that, to committing a part of my day every day to living in the dreams of Black women, girls, and gender expansive people. To living as though I'm already in freedom as place, and to being open to remaking what freedom looks like and what freedom means as I learn more about others' freedom dreams and what other people are contending with and how we excise ourselves from that kind of unfreedom.
And that's all the time we have for That's How It Wrapped Up on February 23rd at the University of Louisville, when we heard from Dr. Trevia Lindsay, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University and author of the brand new book, America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice. It was a fantastic evening. You can learn more about the Minx Auerbach Annual Lecture and Dr. Trevia Lindsay at louisville.edu/WGS. That's all the time we have for today here on Truth to Power. This is Justin Moggs signing off. We'll be back in your ears again in 1 week's time, my friends. Be well.